everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, America's unpreparedness for severe solar storms, and why our electric grids are particularly vulnerable, and what are the consequences? From Los Angeles, Lawrence Joseph, one of America's most seasoned investigative journalists. He's been reporting on science, nature, political issues for a quarter of a century, writing for the New York Times, Discovery, Huffington Post, many others. And during the past several years, he's been conducting in-depth research into different phenomena that explore solar physics, astronomical phenomena, and climate change. He's written several books dealing with the Gaia hypothesis and the impact of solar activity and climate change upon civilization. His most recent book is Solar Cataclysm: How the Sun Shaped the Past and What We Can Do to Save Our Future, a continuation of his earlier work dealing with the science behind the potential catastrophes resulting solar activity, energy, polar cap melts, climate change, and agriculture. Nice to have you with us today.
My pleasure, Gary.
First, please provide us with an update on any recent scientific data or discoveries measuring magnetic storms and coronal mass ejections from the sun and recent sunspot and solar flare activity, because I was watching some of the NASA reports and saw a video of a solar flare off the back end of the sun that was really large. Had that been in our orbit, we would not be speaking today, because a substantial amount of the grids in the world, if it was hit directly, would be simply burned out. But we were fortunate. It didn't happen. But that's not the first time in recent times that we have missed a solar storm, a solar flare. So take us on that discussion first, please.
Well, nobody marks the date July 23rd, 2012 as anything significant, or at least very few people do. But that was a day when we could have gone down. And by gone down, I mean the power grids around the world have been disabled for months or years. And that's not according to my opinion. That's according to the not only NASA, but the National Academy of Sciences, which is no fringe group. It was founded by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, and is generally considered to be the most esteemed scientific body in the world. So let me tell you what we just missed. Periodically, the sun issues explosions, solar flares that toss blobs of plasma harmlessly out into space. Every now and then, one of those blobs, and I like to think of it as just a piece of the sun being spat at us and hitting us, it hits us. And that's what the Earth's magnetic field is for, to protect us against those incursions. But on July 23rd, 2012, we just missed being hit by a blob that would have taken us down and put us back into the 18th century. At least that's the way NASA reports it, but I beg to differ with them. Because 18th century pre-electric society, people knew how to live without electricity. We don't. If we were all of a sudden found ourselves deprived of electricity, we'd not only be without telecom, but we would be without refrigeration, most law enforcement, military security, pumps for gas and water would be knocked out. We would be in an 18th century situation without the 18th century knowledge of how to live like that. If we had heard about an asteroid that was big enough to knock modern civilization back two centuries, it would be the talk of the world. But this blob, because it's more amorphous and less understood, went by relatively unnoticed. In fact, it took scientists about a year to recalculate that the data that it had existed at all. So we've got a situation that's extremely dangerous. And it harkens back to 1859, which is the last time a major solar blob or coronal mass ejection, is the proper term is, hit us. And that was known as the Carrington event. And that's all often pointed to as the turning point in our understanding of solar physics. The idea that the sun could harm us, not just in terms of sunburn or skin cancer, things like that, but actually deal us a death blow. Why didn't the 1859 Carrington event, if it was as big as the one we just missed 2 years ago, why didn't it knock us out? Well, we didn't have a power grid. Society was largely unelectrified. Same thing when 1921 we were hit by a very large solar storm. The electricity was being used, but there was no grid per se. Each city had its own generator and perhaps was connected to the neighboring city through a backup system, but it wasn't megawatts flying around the grid as there are today. So there was nothing to knock out. That's the bad news. The good news is there's really a relatively simple, not easy, but simple way to protect ourselves. Much as you protect your computer equipment and your plasma TV with a surge suppressor, we can do the same with our power grid by protecting the most important transformers that would be knocked out in case of a solar storm. All we have to do is install surge suppressors around the grid. It would cost, estimates run from $500 million to $2 billion, which is a lot of money, but not that much considering what we would be saving ourselves. You can protect the grid. And let me reiterate, what we're protecting is not just the electricity supply, but the society that depends so totally on electricity. Anybody who's gone through a blackout for a couple of days can begin to imagine the terrible inconvenience, but the danger of being knocked out for months or years, as the National Academy of Sciences said, is positively incomprehensible to most of us. May I tell you why it would take that long to get the...
Yes.
There's... The vulnerable points in the power grid are the largest transformers. Transformers step down or step up the flow of electricity to connect it properly from generating stations to communities and then to homes. The big transformers operate within very small tolerances, and a little injection of electricity from the sun, which is essentially what the plasma blob would do as it crashes through our magnetic defense, fries the transformers. It doesn't just incapacitate them temporarily, but it fuses their copper winding, so they have to be replaced. Right now, for the largest and most important transformers, there's a 3-year waiting list on the world market. None of them, by the way, none of these of the largest transformers are made in the United States anymore. Made in India, Brazil, far-flung places. To knock out these transformers, if they were knocked out, we would have a terrible situation because we'd have to wait 3 years, and we'd be at the mercy of foreign powers, not necessarily malevolent foreign powers, but foreign powers nonetheless. And you say, well, why don't we just stock up on them? We just fill a few warehouses with them in case. I wish it were that easy, but transformers are calibrated to their specific point in the power grid, so you can't just sort of one size fit all. But there is this simple solution of placing a surge suppressor in between the ground and the transformer to protect the transformers. Basically, what happens when the solar storm hits, the plasma crashes through the Earth's atmosphere, goes into the ground, and then pops back up out of the ground to fry the transformers. This is not a hypothetical conjecture. This happened in 1989 in Quebec, where 9 million people lost power. It was March, and it was cold, and some lost it for up to I think it was 3 weeks. And that was a tiny storm that just happened to hit there. Tiny compared to the July 22nd, 2000, July 23rd, 2012 storm. Tiny compared to the Carrington event. Tiny compared to the one that hit 1921. Tiny compared to that which we're going to be hit by sooner or later. These are not, it's not just some one-off anomaly. There's a regular occurrence. It may not occur on any given schedule that we can discern. But these things are hitting us or near missing us all the time. And by deploying surge suppressors throughout the grid, we can save ourselves. I've got good news and bad news on how the surge suppressor deployment is going.
What is
May
it?
Can I tell you?
Sure.
The bad news is that the House of Representatives in 2010 voted unanimously to deploy surge suppressors to protect the grid. I think that was astonishingly cohesive given, you know, how fractious the Congress is. However, the Senate scuttled the bill in committee and it never came to a vote. That's tantamount to signing our death warrant. So upsetting, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times imploring the Senate to reconsider.
Why did it? Who in the Senate killed it and why?
It got bottled up in committee. A senator from Alaska seems to have led the opposition, but it was, I can't say exactly who. The why is because the North American Electric Reliability Council, the lobbying group for the power grid, opposed it, and they saw it as a territorial incursion on their power and their domain.
They didn't see this as...
They didn't like anything. You know, it was sort of an anti-regulatory reflex.
But the results of this could be apocalyptic.
Absolutely, and that you're not being hyperbolic. Apocalyptic is right. Can you imagine going months or years without electricity in your home? You can't just get your car and drive away because the gas pumps are electric.
But that brings Larry, just for a moment, because we take for granted that the Earth's electromagnetic field is what enables life to thrive on this planet, and without it, there would be no life as we know it. It was about 4 billion years ago when our sun eradicated Mars's electromagnetic field and turned it into the barren red planet. And back in 2008, NASA had a shocking discovery of the unexpected loss of much of the Earth's electromagnetic sphere, making our civilization even more vulnerable to solar flare activity.
And 90%
loss. 90%
loss,
and yet the average person was unaware of it or its significance. So few people, Larry, truly grasp the larger ramifications regarding how heavily dependent we are upon readily available electricity, and at the same time, how vulnerable and how endangered our lives become when we don't have access to electricity over a longer period of time. And few people even realize how dependent all of our, for example, domestic law enforcement is upon reliable access to electricity and the implications of simply social order in the absence of it. So take this time now, please, and paint us a broader picture showing just how much our lives depend thoroughly upon electricity, and particularly for those living in crowded urban and suburban settings, and what would happen if the electric went out for, let's say, and it's reasonable to expect it to go out for, let's say, a month. If one of these major flares hits, unless you're on a different grid, maybe down south, the whole eastern quarter going from Florida up to Boston, across to Chicago, down through Illinois, that would all be impacted. The northwestern quarter would be impacted. Most of California, there would be some places that would not be as impacted. But let's just look hypothetically at a 30-day without electricity. Could you work with us on that, and do you feel that that would be somewhat realistic as what would happen if we got hit with the Carrington effect?
I think it's actually a conservative estimate, because according to the National Academy of Sciences, being hit with the equivalent of the Carrington event, and again, the July 23rd, 2012 storm was equivalent to the Carrington event or greater than the Carrington event, so this is not just perverse speculation. They say we would be without electricity for months or years. Yeah, you know, the first couple of days would actually be kind of fun, or would have that sort of, oh, it's a blackout, let's get out the candles, and we don't watch TV, and we talk and we sing. You know, there's a certain festive potential to that, where people are helpful to each other, and, you know, it seems like, you know, we would soldier through it and perhaps even have a little bit of fun. By the end of the first week, though, begin to get situations where elderly, folks with medical problems, folks who need their medicine refrigerated, would rely on medical devices, would begin to really suffer. I mean, hospitals have backup generators that can go for a week or two. Depends on the hospital. Depends on how fit they are. But by the end of the second week, desperation really begins to mount. On the personal level, I mean, a lot of people say, well, it's time to get off the grid and have their own electricity supply. And I think that is a good idea, but I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to be the only house in the neighborhood with electricity. I suppose I'd rather be that than not, but I'd have people knocking at my door or, worse, coming in my window to, you know, sustain themselves. And while their actions would probably not be moral or legal, who could blame them if they're, you know, acting out of survival mode?
Larry, let me share a few thoughts, and you tell me whether or not these are reasonable or unreasonable, all right? Because I've spent the time months trying to figure out how we would survive this. But you have to break it down into its pieces. For example, let's say that this solar flare happens and your electricity goes out in the daytime. As you say, initially people won't know what caused it, because when they turn on television or their computer, the internet, there's not going to be anything there. Their cell phones may work as long as the battery works, but the information getting to them is also going to be blocked because a lot of satellites will be knocked out. So, as you said, people might think, okay, we're out of power for a while, but it'll come back on. Power lines down the neighborhood, something happened. It's the unknown that will both interest people, but also initially probably not terrify them. But it depends upon the time of year. We're expecting to have one of the worst winters, if not the worst winter, in New York history. New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Vermont are supposed to have the worst, coldest winter in our history. So if this happened in the middle of one of those days, now you don't have heat, because that's all electricity. You don't have toilets. You don't have water. Your refrigerator and freezer will turn off, and that'll last several days. What's in the freezer will last until it's maybe 3 or 4 days. You could still use it, depending upon what it is. But then you start to realize you didn't have batteries, you didn't have candles, you didn't have flashlights, you didn't have a backpack, you didn't have any of the things you need. And you didn't even have gas enough in your car. The only information you're going to have is some people who are immediately in the neighborhood, and they're going to be asking you the same thing. What happened? The police are not going to be able to get out and tell everyone in every area. They're going to be, first and foremost, they're going to be trying to get people out of banks, because the bank's doors are going to be locked and there's no way a person could break out of a bank because the windows are bulletproof and there's timers on the doors. Think of the people stuck in elevators. There could be thousands in one city stuck in elevators. Then in the hospitals, you are correct, there's a backup system. But we saw from Katrina and we saw from Sandy that these backup generators they have sometimes didn't work because they were at the water level and they were flooded out. Other times they didn't have backup propane or backup, they didn't generally use propane, that would have been wiser. They didn't have enough backup diesel. They had a day's worth a week's worth at the most. Now you got to think, what's it like to be a patient in a nursing home, a hospice, or what's it like to be in a hospital where you have to have electricity for heart monitor or heart-lung machine, or to you can't do surgery in the dark. They'd literally have to be doing surgery in daylight in front of windows where there's no sanitation and massive bacterial infection, viral infection. There's no sanitation. You couldn't wash your hands. You could use some disinfectant, but that's going to run out quickly because most hospitals, most stores, most people only have about a week to 2's worth of backup supplies. Now, let's say you're a parent and your kids are at school. Your kids normally go on a school bus. You got to find a way to get to school to get them. Now, if it's just a block away or 2 blocks away, what if it's several miles away? You've got to get there, get your kids, and get back. What if one of the spouses is working downtown? Let's say just as Manhattan, working down in the garment industry, which is in the 30s, or down on Wall Street. But you live in Scarsdale, and your kids are in another area. You got to pick up your kids, and you got to all meet. Right now, because all the roads are going to be jammed because there's no traffic lights, so the police are going to be trying to help that. And with no traffic lights, you know the kind of accidents are going to happen. Everything will grind to a grid stop. Long Island will be just an expressway like a parking lot. There will be no traffic moving. And that means that people won't be able to get gas. So if you're on a highway and you run out of gas, people are going to have to push a car off the road, and there are going to be a lot of angry people because they want to get someplace and they're not able to. Airlines won't be able to fly. Could you imagine, unless it's daylight, because their electronics are going to go out and their broadcast for the controller's not going to be able to reach you. Now, they do have the capacity to manually fly, but an awful lot of that plane now has been computerized, and it's based upon matching computers on the ground. That is going to be a big problem. If you're in a smaller plane, not a problem. If you're in a big plane, a jumbo jet, and let's say it's nighttime and you got rain, you got fog, how are you going to see land? All you have now is you have no radio connection. You're just going to have sight. Big problem. You're going to have planes crashing all over the place and no new planes taking off.
You also, and the land won't be visible because the lights will be largely out.
They're all going to be out. All the lights will be out. And because the backup generators don't power those lights. They only power what's needed in the tower. Then you're going to have, after about 3 or 4 days, people have eaten the food they have. They will have drank whatever beverages they have. The people have gone to the stores. And just like before a hurricane, you go to any Home Depot before a hurricane, all the wood's gone because they're getting 4x8s, plywood, nail up their walls. All of the candles, everything's going to be gone because it's not just few people in one isolated area near the ocean fearing a rise in the water. It's the entire state. So it's one thing to have 200,000 people living at the ocean who've got to prepare for a storm. It's something else having 20 million people living within 50 miles of New York City, 20 million. So now you've got 20 million people, and there's no food getting to them. The only food that's there is the ones that were at Hunts Point Market and other distribution points and trucks that may have gotten there that had enough fuel to get through. But those trucks can only go so far, about generally maximum 200 miles, and they have to get more diesel. All of those diesel pumps are going to be down. Hence, people are going to be coming up with unique ways to siphon gas out of those tanks or start stealing other people's gasoline. So by the time you're a family and you've got kids and your kids don't have the food and they don't have the water and you're looking at each other and you're blaming each other, why didn't you know this? Why didn't you prepare? And you get through your initial anger, then you think, what about mom? You know, mom's up there living alone in her apartment and she didn't have anything, but mom's got high blood pressure and she's got elevated cholesterol and she's got to have her blood thinning medication. So now you got to get to mom. So you think, well, let's take a bike. We'll just ride a bike over to mom's. It might take 3 or 4 hours, but we'll get there. So you ride your bike over to mom's. You get to mom's and find out that mom hasn't had any water to drink in the last 2 days and has been living off some canned beans that she had and some other canned stuff. But mom's out of food. Mom's out of medication. But you then go down to the pharmacies, and all the pharmacies are closed and everything's gone because there's no electricity. And then you go to the hospital, and all the hospitals are now out of electricity, and they're being abandoned. But there was no place to take the people. So literally a group of volunteers stood behind hoping the electricity come back, and the others were out on emergency calls. Now, there were some capacities with shortwave radios to get some messages out and to try to find what's happening. And then when word finally comes that this was a power outage and it may be several months, then it's like getting hit in the nose and the stomach simultaneously by Mike Tyson. You suddenly wake up to a different reality. Oh, my God, we are not prepared. So now you've got clothes, so you're not going to freeze to death, but you don't have food and you don't have water. So you start looking for water, but any water you get out of a creek, a stream, a swimming pool, you're going to end up with parasites. You're going to end up, if it's a stream or a river, you're going to end up with anything that's in there, what we call beaver fever. And then you're going to have diarrhea, but the trouble is you don't have any way to rehydrate from diarrhea, and a lot of people die from dehydration, from diarrhea in third world countries. So America has now suddenly 1.5 million people dying per year under normal circumstances, and now you have no place to put these dead people, nor any way of getting them, because most people don't want to touch a dead person. But you got people dying everywhere, and especially in the hospitals, the hospices, and the nursing homes, the assisted living centers. By the tens of thousands, they begin to die because they don't have water, they don't have attendants. And at a certain point, a doctor, a nurse, an orderly still has to take care of their family. So as much as they would want to help the patient and would, under any circumstance, do so, they also realize that their family is at home and they've been hearing about the big problem now. The big problem are gangs, because nobody can call the police because there's no way to reach the police. So therefore, people can commit crimes, they can rob places with impunity. Now, it's not a riot as in the traditional sense of outrage and people burn something. This is where people break into people's homes and steal anything they want, knowing there's no one going to call the police, there's no security cameras, and there's utter chaos. Then people are both outside trying to find out what's going on and terrified of being outside because it's Mad Max. It's even the richest of the rich will send out their people, but then their people say, I'm not your people anymore. I've got to take care of myself. You take care of your own rich self. And the people say, but we don't have anything. Well, you've got a $30 million apartment. You've got gowns and everything. Right now, the only thing you need is not a $30 million apartment. And, you need food and water. And you have neither. And I have no way of getting it for you. And then all the rich and powerful began finally to have a little karma in this lifetime. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes them in their homes before they run out of fuel and have to burn furniture and clothes and other things, not realizing how dangerous that is, and also where they're going to go to eat. The first thing, probably they'd be eating their dog or cat. Remember, when people are starving, you're dealing then with people who are thinking through a limbic system. They're thinking primordially. They're thinking of surviving. And if you have kids, you're going to do things that under normal circumstances you would never think of doing. So after 2 months, you will probably have the big first kill-off, the people who have died from inclement weather, either hot or cold, the people who have died of dehydration, weakened immune systems, medical conditions that could no longer be attended to, life support systems that are failed, and people who have heart attacks or strokes under normal conditions have a chance of living and don't have any chance now because they're just going to have a heart attack and stay there until they die. You also have all the people with all the different meds. Think of all the people who've got to get off cold turkey selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor. You try going off Paxil, cold turkey, you will be completely psychotic, delusional. In fact, 95...
Well, that might help, yeah. Because one of the versions of reality you're going to want to avoid is the chain of nuclear meltdowns that is occurring, because virtually all of the 104 nuclear power plants in the United States rely on an electricity supply from conventional plants. They're not self-sustaining. So after 4 to 6 weeks of no electricity input, the cooling mechanisms in the nuclear plants fail. And you've got a chain of meltdowns occurring across the country. So it might be good to be disconnected from reality at that point, because you don't want to know what will happen after that.
Well, there's only two things I think the average American would find so devastating that emotionally they couldn't handle it. Not being able to refill their prescription medications for Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, kids with Ritalin, and most people watching The Life of the Kardashians. I don't know which one they'll find worse and go into reaction mode. But there will be no more movies. There will be no more television at that time. There will be no radio shows. A person will be simply left with the means of survival as best they can. And then the people who at least thought well enough to try to make a life sustainable won't be considered such eccentrics or nut jobs. They'll be looked upon as people that make sense. Now, you made a statement earlier, Larry, and I want you to follow up on this. You wouldn't want to be the only person in the neighborhood who had electricity because, without question, people would be coming there to get water, to get food, to get heat. And in that chaotic environment, you don't know who's going to be armed and suddenly take control of your environment for their survival. So you better understand that if you don't have a good plan, A, how to get out of town to a safer location with other people hopefully working cooperatively in advance. So if this should happen, here's what we're going to do. Here's plan A, here's plan B, and here's plan C. That you better have some plans for surviving a solar storm, or I believe that we're going to see about one-third of the entire American population within 12 months will be dead. Does that sound like an exaggeration? Is anything I just said in my scenario, is that exaggerated or realistic to your perspective?
Well, I thought, frankly, in certain parts it was understated because you've got, for example, here in Southern California, we've gone through the worst heat wave that we've experienced in a long time and a drought, getting temperatures of 110 degrees for weeks on end without air conditioning would drive people every bit as crazy as not having heat in cold weather. And here we are so much more dependent upon cars than y'all are in the New York area. We'd be that much more out of luck than you with a mass transit system that might have at least some residual, some emergency ability. I don't know what the backup situation is in there, but I can hope that there would be at least some hope for transportation for a while. We don't have even that. Without our cars, we are nothing out here. But I want to give you the good news now, because we've certainly rung the alarm bell pretty loudly. The good news is that even though the Senate screwed us, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which oversees the power grid, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which oversees the civilian production of nuclear power in the United States, have both adopted basically our surge suppressor proposals and then made them regulations. And while the implementation has not begun yet, it's still only on paper and in word, that's a step in the right direction. What's also a step in the right direction, and I want to see my reason for coming on the show particularly, is to applaud the state of Maine, which the legislature there passed a law mandating the protection of the power grid within that state. And again, through the insertion of surge suppressors to protect against solar blasts. If the Maine legislation could be used as model legislation, basically pick it up and just adapt it slightly to the specifics of each state, we could make great progress in protecting the grid. And we don't have to wait for freaking Washington to pass laws.
Could you please send me a copy of that so we can post it? So everyone, we're heard all over the world. We're in 166 countries. We're everywhere in America. People are listening to us now. So could you send that and I'll post it, and that way they can start putting this as a referendum in their state on the ballots to mandate it as a law?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been talking this up to everybody I know. I had my 40th college reunion at Brown University a couple months ago. And I realized that I'm no longer the party boy I used to be, because I was buttonholing everybody if they knew legislators and lobbyists and the like, to spread the word. And, well, I probably didn't win Mr. Popularity, but a number of people helped. People want to do something, and they will do something if you present it as you have today.
My conclusion here is this. You have laid out a very important and very positive solution. That is, surge protectors, just like the ones we use on computers, but more sophisticated and much larger, because they have to protect large power stations, and that we can do this if we have the will. And Maine has shown that it's possible. Therefore, like Bannister breaking the four-minute mile, they said it was impossible after he did it. Shortly thereafter, numerous people did it within a very short period of time. Now we know that Maine has done it. We can all get behind this. So that's the good news. The bad news, and also I believe that irrespective of what anything happens, I believe that we should be reasonable and responsible in a timely manner to actually look for what we can do individually as families and friends, so that we have a plan. And it's always best to do things with people. I believe the future, we survive better if there's we instead of me. And by looking at all the things that are possible, you know, and we've discussed that at length in previous programs. And my final question is, or statement is this, and then I'd like you to respond to it, please. Since there seems to be a growing consensus in the scientific community that we are due for potential catastrophic electromagnetic pulses, or CMEs, have any preventative steps been taken within the United States governmental agencies or the energy industry? You've mentioned Maine. You've mentioned what was done there. But for the government, do you feel that the government could be pressured into doing this, or the utility industries pressured into complying and following this this proposal?
Well, as I mentioned, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which oversees the grid, although with limited power of authority, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have both adopted the essential surge suppressor approach as regulations. Now, implementing and enforcing those regulations is another question. I mean, basically, right now, it's a very nice piece of paper or, you know, digitized data. But there's incredible inertia, and there's many ways of delaying the implementation, because the power grid is one of the strangest legal creatures that could exist. It's this patchwork of public, private, multi-state authorities, all sorts of corporate structures, and it's very difficult to just overcome not the legal opposition, just to manage the beast. And so consequently, it's very easy to delay any progress. So the government, being unable to pass the proper legislation, at least has issued regulations that are, you know, good intention, but we all know the road to hell is paved with good intentions. In this case, the road to hell will be paved with good intentions if intentions are all that are issued and there's no real follow-up.
But Larry, you've made your point and you've made it well, and I thank you for articulating it. You get me that piece of legislation and we'll see that it gets out to a lot of people around the world so that they can take this and run with it. And I look forward to having you back on in, let's say, 3 to 5 months from now, when we know that we'll actually get some grassroots moving state by state, community by community to do this. Because if we can get the people at the grassroots level to inspire this at the community level, and you get the communities inspiring their states, and the states then have to do something, and that's where we're going to work. We're going to look for solutions on this, and I thank you very much for all the good work you've done and your commitment to this higher ideal. Thank you.
My pleasure, and from your lips to God's ears, Gary, I will get you that today.
Larry Joseph, my guest from Los Angeles, doing very important work out there, life-saving work. And his website is lawrencejoseph.com. His book is Solar Cataclysm, How the Sun Shaped the Past and What We Can Do to Save Our Future. Back in a moment. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The role of solar outbursts in our ancient past and their effects on early civilizations. My guest is Professor Robert Schock. He is in Boston, Massachusetts. He's a professor of geology at the College of General Studies at Boston University, where he's taught since 1984 after receiving his doctorate in geophysics from Yale University. Please share with us what the science tells us about more severe solar plasma and solar proton emissions, and what impact might these more severe storms have had upon life on Earth. And also, take your time and describe what geologists are discovering about the effects of these storms. The forum is yours.
These dramatic changes occurred at the end of the last ice age, and one of the big questions geologically has always been, and this is how I got into it, always been what caused the ice age to end so abruptly, so quickly, and getting back to the ancient civilizations that were developing, I'm now convinced, based on the evidence, at the end of the last ice age. In fact, the evidence is so strong, it's irrefutable at this point, that we had a cycle of civilization at the end of the last ice age. They were absolutely devastated. Sort of humans were thrown into what I call a dark age. So what accounted for this? When you start looking at the evidence, including isotope data, including what scientists like to call by the fancy name of siliceous scoria-like fragments, which basically is referring to vitrification, melt, rock that has been subjected to incredible discharges of electricity, high temperatures. It's caused them to melt, and then you find these little fragments at archaeological sites. Some people know it as vitrification. You find data like that. You find that there's been major evidence of catastrophe at the sites. Putting this all together, but particularly the isotope data, which you can correlate, and we do this in recent times, so we know the correlation is good for beryllium, for instance, isotopes that form in conjunction with major solar activity. You can plot solar activity. What we find is that there was incredible solar activity at the very end of the last ice age. So to put it in very simple terms, a major, major solar outburst. At the end of the last ice age, 9,700 BC, which caused, if you were live back then, you would have seen, well, think of the northern lights, the aurora borealis. That would have been seen worldwide, but would have been much more intense. It would have looked like, in some cases, huge sparks or lightning bolts coming down, hitting Earth. This caused major warming of the climate virtually instantaneously. In some cases, you'd have huge sparks hitting the surface, literally. That's what causes the vitrification locally. In other cases, you would look up in the sky. It would look like dancing figures. You mentioned the 1859 Carrington event. People described dancing figures in the sky. This event, based on the isotope data and the other data that we have, was much more severe, I believe, by orders of magnitude than what we had in 1859, which was relatively minor geophysically and geologically. So this huge solar outburst, it would have melted glaciers very, very quickly as temperatures changed, releasing the pressure as these glaciers melted. You release pressure on the crust, it would have caused not just landslides, but earthquakes. It would have increased volcanic activity around the world. We know this occurs because even in the modern day, when we look at modern global warming, which is not even close to how fast it occurred, I believe, at the end of the last ice age, we see, and this has been measured, increased volcanic and earthquake activity, for instance, in Iceland. As we have the glaciers melting there very, very quickly. as you melt the glaciers as fire, you can think of it as fire or electrical sparks hitting the surface in some cases, the overall global warming, you would put a lot of moisture into the atmosphere. This would come down as penetrating rains, incredible rains, which you see in many legends. I would not base any of the scenario on myths and legends, but it's interesting that the legends confirm that ancient people sort of had a recollection of these types of things. There were rising sea levels. That's been known for a very long time, that you had rising sea levels at the end of the last ice age, over 300 meters, actually, from the low. So incredible changes. And on top of everything else, you would have had what we now might call solar particle events or solar proton events. The ozone layer would have been disrupted. The magnetic shield of the Earth was disrupted. More cosmic radiation came into the Earth system, would have penetrated to the ground. It's been calculated that in some cases, in some areas, you would have had such high radiation levels that it would have been lethal to certain large mammals within days or a week at most. What do we see at the end of the last ice age? We see smaller animals surviving, but larger animals being wiped out, including humans in some areas. How do you escape this? One way is to go underground, into caves, into rock shelters, where you can escape the surface radiation, at least for short periods of time. And one thing I want to point out is that this would have sort of come, and then it would have backed off a little bit, then you now have another outburst from the sun. So it's not a situation where it was absolutely continuous for years, but what the isotope data indicates is that you'd have sort of progressive outbursts. I'm a geologist, so I'd like to use the analogy sometimes of earthquakes. You have a major, major earthquake, but before earthquake, you generally have foreshocks, then you have more aftershocks, and then you may have another major earthquake again, depending on the context. So it was a very perilous, very serious situation at the end of the last ice age, and we, I believe, are finding the evidence both geologically, sedimentologically, astrophysically, archaeologically, that this is what happened back then, and these early civilizations, this early, what I call this earlier cycle of civilization, which was, flourishing toward the end of the last ice age, was absolutely devastated, as one would expect, honestly. And I'm using the term now that there was a solar-induced dark age for thousands of years. The sun, when you look at the isotope data, the sun was very, very erratic. That's another important point. At the end of the last ice age, it was incredibly variable. So not only did you have very high spikes in activity, but this was punctuated by periods of what would have seemed like dormancy for short periods of time before it exploded again. So a lot of variability, a lot of erratic behavior. If you were living back then and you experienced a huge solar outburst and then everything seemed to calm down and nothing was happening, you might sit back with a sigh of relief, but that would have been a mistake because another one would follow shortly thereafter. And I think that the people that were surviving were picking up on this pattern, so they were trying to make preparations for the next one that would come, digging out caves, making preparations, those that were able to survive and hang on. Over centuries after the last ice age, the sun started to stabilize. It became less erratic, and it stabilized and went to a relatively low level for thousands of years. We're talking 8,000 to 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age. And it was during this period that civilization was able to reemerge. People sort of got back onto their feet metaphorically. Civilization developed, and, we pick up the standard story over the last 5,000 years of getting to the point where we are today with technological, high technological civilization.
I appreciate these insights. We know that sun activity goes through various approximate cycles. The 11-year cycle is the most common.
Mm-hmm.
However, scientists suspect that there is even a 12,000-year cycle.
Exactly.
That may be upon us now. And going back into ancient history, this would place us in the kind of prehistoric dark age of humanity's history and the end of the last ice age. What can you tell us about this longer cycle, including the fact that the sun's activity is becoming more erratic and volatile during the past 50 or so years, which might indicate that large events could be facing us?
Well, I am absolutely convinced at this point, based on the data, that the sun does have this 12,000-year, approximately 12,000-year cycle that you just mentioned. And if you think about when was the end of the last ice age, 12,000 years ago. So things seem to be fitting. One thing I've been thinking about and working on, too, is if you go back further in time, because I'm a geologist, so going back further in time, we have a series of ice ages. We have earlier, I don't even want to call it civilizations before the end of the last ice age, but we have humanity. Everyone probably has heard of Neanderthals and the other populations that were existing in the world back in the ice ages. And the data is now tentative at the moment, but I believe we can trace this cycle, about 12,000 or so year cycle, going back further in time and tying in with earlier cycles of ice ages, earlier cycles of humanity, or some people want to call it proto-humanity because some of the species are not necessarily the same as us biologically. So I think that's very important. And when you have cycles like that, I'm a geologist. These things don't just stop. They continue into the present day. They continue into the future. So given that we have this cycle, or let's assume that we have this 12,000-year cycle, we are right on time, if you would, for going into a volatile, erratic period for the sun. You just mentioned it in the last 50, 70 years. We have seen spikes in solar activity, and now this is very good data because it's observational data tied in with the isotope data. We have seen spikes in solar activity, which is exactly what we saw at the beginning of the end of the last ice age, if I could put it that way, right at the end of the last ice age. So we are seeing all the same signs, I am convinced, that we had at the end of the last ice age of spikes of activity, of volatility, erratic behavior. If you follow the sun on a day-by-day basis, as I do, right now people say, oh, maybe we're going into a dormant period. Maybe we're going into a period where the sun is going to go quiet. Well, that's what you had at the end of the last ice age, too, if you were following it day by day. And then it explodes again.
Well, I would challenge those people because just a couple of weeks ago, we had one of the most extreme sunburst in history. It was just on the other side of the sun.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So we have to be very, very diligent, very careful about this because that's the other factor. We can have these extreme ones. And there was a big one, of course, in 2012, but we missed it barely. Barely, yes, exactly, by 2 weeks. So we have this incredible activity, even if people can still be complacent. When I say people, the average person that I feel just doesn't want to know the information.
It scares them. Let's go into two areas here. So on the one hand, we know, and it's not hypothesis, it is fact, that the sun in 2012 and recently has had extreme activity.
Exactly.
And the most extreme, in fact, they said it dwarfed the Carrington effect just a couple of weeks ago, but we were fortunate that it was in going against the other side of the sun and not towards Earth. We also know that the Earth's electromagnetic shield has been weakening over the decades.
That's right. It's gone down by at least, I believe, 15% over the last 150 years or so,
now then
which is an incredible amount, and it's gone down by, you know, maybe a third or more in the last couple of millennia. And again, that may sound like a long time for the average person, but I'm a geologist. 2,000 years is nothing.
Well, then let's put this in perspective. If I believe that there's something critical in our need to understand as lay people, what happens if a larger solar storm hits the Earth, and what relevance that has on the fears of a flipping of the Earth's poles, and also, based upon the scientific evidence, do you have any idea what the risks of an extreme solar proton emission event would have to plant, animal, and human life?
Okay, so a couple of questions there. As far as the Earth's magnetic field, it is weakening as far as we can measure it at the moment. It continues to weaken at a possibly increasing rate. It's a really dramatic weakening, and this has a lot of implications. First off, we use the magnetic field for many practical applications, but more importantly, the magnetic field helps shield us from solar storms, from solar events, that type of thing. So with a weakened magnetic field, we become all the more vulnerable. So that's a major concern. We are also becoming more vulnerable, in my assessment, and I think in anyone that studied this, they would agree with this, every day, literally every day, because of our increasing reliance on microelectronics, satellite systems, electrical grid systems, that type of thing. There is now evidence of something you just mentioned, a major solar proton event. There's evidence that this occurred based in particular on, again, isotope data from certain sediment cores, that there was a major solar proton event at the end of the last ice age. That is, these incredibly high-speed protons being thrown off by the sun, colliding, to put it very simply, colliding with the Earth, penetrating down to the surface of the Earth. Now, back then, at the end of the last ice age, as far as we know, no one had sophisticated electronics and cell phones and, you know, laptop computers, that type of thing. A major solar proton event in our society, in our day, could, I believe, based on, again, the evidence that we've tried to accumulate and test, it could cause serious damage even to people's private personal electronic devices, put them out of service, that type of thing, much less what is going to happen to the grid system, to satellite communications. So, you know, when we're looking at a society that is entirely dependent, and I hate to put it that way, and I don't want to be a fearmonger. I think that, you know, what we really need to do is move to action collectively to try to strengthen and fortify the system, you know, work together. But right now we're incredibly vulnerable as a society. Most people would not know what to do without their electronic gadgets, without their electrical grid system supplying effectively all their necessities for them.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. The book is Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outburst in Our Past and Future. Thank you very much, Professor Robert Schock, for being on to share your insights on the role of solar outburst in our ancient past and their effect on early civilizations and what it portends for us if we do not become proactive. I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Commentary Hour.